There is a real ick factor in our culture when it comes to talking about death and dying. After a certain age, we realize we'll die someday, but we generally don't relish thinking about it. And we often find ourselves less than prepared when end-of-life issues present themselves, usually with the care of our aging parents. Those are the issues today's guest faced a few years ago. Katie Butler has published articles in many magazines, including the New York Times Magazine, The New Yorker, and The Best American Science Writing. Her book on what she and her parents faced and the larger implications for all of us is called Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. Katie Butler is our guest today on The Exchange. Katie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey. I'm happy to be here.
Your parents were quite accomplished in their lives from the sounds of it. Tell us a bit about them.
Well, my father lost his arm in the Second World War. He and my mother then left South Africa, which was their native country, moved to England, where he re-educated himself as a history professor, and then emigrated a second time with their three kids to the U.S., where he built a beautiful and prosperous life in Connecticut, where he was a college professor. My mother was a very talented amateur artist who always underplayed her own gifts. She practiced calligraphy, she sewed all her own clothes, she deeply loved my dad, and she created an absolutely beautiful kind of Zen aesthetic home in a very modern house on a hillside in Connecticut.
Did your father teach at Wesleyan University?
Yes, he taught at Wesleyan University and was very, very happy there.
Your parents had apparently taken pretty good care of themselves, and so what kind of shape were they in by the time they got to their late 70s?
Well, they were living the American myth of later life, which is that we're going to sail along eating our fruits and vegetables and hiking and keeping ourselves in shape, and somehow nothing is going to happen to us until suddenly we die quietly in our sleep. But actually very, very few of us die that way now. And so when my parents hit their late 70s, they were hiking 2 hours a day. They were meditating almost every morning. My mother was practicing yoga. She was a fantastic cook and, you know, kind of a Dean Ornish low-fat cooker. And they were both incredibly healthy and living out that American dream of the golden years.
But as you say, it's also a myth because very few of us actually get to go through that to the point where we actually do die in our sleep.
Exactly, because we now have medical technologies that have all but abolished natural death or sudden death. It's almost impossible to die suddenly and very, very difficult to die naturally. And so they were very, you know, my mother was, you know, she didn't always buy organic food, but she was certainly a health person. And that doesn't actually prevent us from the major tragedies and blindsiding blows of what we are now calling late old age, that period over 80 or so when people are kind of like Humpty Dumpty. It's like they still look pretty good from the outside, but something can really set them off on a disastrous course.
And parts do wear out is really what it gets down to, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, exactly. It's like I've heard cardiologists say they think the heart just has so many beats in it, and all kinds of things happen. We actually age in 7,000 different ways if you really look at the cellular level of everything. So, for example, the heart, it has all kinds of little nerve fibers in it, and those fibers just slowly die off as we age. And in my father's case, when he was probably his mid-70s, his heart just started to slow down as a result of having fewer of these nerve fibers that send electrical impulses from one part of the heart to the other.
But the major issue with your father was ultimately a stroke. I mean, that was what
yes.
sort of began the whole long
yeah.
process. And do you remember, was it one of those things where you always remember where you were and what
yes.
you were doing?
Yes. It was that big wake-up call. It was that giant hammer from God saying, you have a lot of things to face and a lot of things are about to change. I remember standing in my house, which is in Mill Valley, California, on the upstairs landing, holding the phone and hearing my mother's voice as she told me that my father had had a stroke. And it was so powerful. Before I even could understand or process her words, I just knew that something completely devastating had happened.
Was there something about her tone of voice or the time of day she was calling or all of the above?
Well, it's probably all of the above. I mean, this was a woman who was in command of her life. She was gorgeous. She was charismatic. She was beautifully dressed. She always was on top of everything. You know, she didn't call you in agony on a regular basis. And the angst, she could hardly get her words out. She just said, "Daddy's had a stroke. Katie, Daddy's had a stroke." And she could barely get out her words, and it's like I knew before I even she finished the sentence that it was terrible.
So there you were in Mill Valley. Your mom's still in, what, Middletown, Connecticut?
Yeah, uh-huh.
This is one of the unfortunate truths about our generation of people, it seems like, is that there's a lot of frequent flyer miles getting run up visiting parents when they're having health issues.
Yes, exactly. And I had moved to California 30 years earlier. I was living a very happy, independent life. I was childless. I was divorced. I had never taken care of anything more complex than a ficus tree. And suddenly, I was being called from the deepest part of my being to become heavily involved with my family again and really, really help out. And I think, you know, we baby boomers, it's really a joke that we still describe ourselves by a word that includes the word baby.
It is kind of funny after 65.
Yes, exactly. And suddenly it was like, okay, childhood is completely over. You know, wanting more money from your family for Christmas is over, and you need to be the giver now and not the taker. And it was in many ways an absolutely wonderful and very healing experience for the whole family, but I don't want to minimize the burden of long-term caregiving and the very difficult medical decisions that fall often on the children, you know, we adult children.
Sound familiar? Many of us have to deal with that very situation. Kay Butler is the author of Knocking on Heaven's Door. She joined us in 2013. Our encore interview continues shortly here on The Exchange. Please stay tuned. On the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Emily Curitan. Thank you for listening today. We've picked a shiny nugget out of our treasure trove of interviews from the past. Kay Butler wrote the book Knocking on Heaven's Door about dealing with the pending death of a loved one, in this case, her father. This is pre-recorded, so we can't take any phone calls or emails this hour. Here's Jeff again.
Katie, I want to get the timing right here because your dad did have a stroke, I think, at age 79. Was his heart condition diagnosed earlier than that or after the stroke?
He'd had a slow heartbeat for several years, but he'd never had any physical consequences. It was just something that showed up on an electrocardiogram. Then, a year after the stroke, he needed a hernia surgery, and therefore he needed a cardiac clearance. And this became kind of for the want of a nail, the shoe was lost. It became the sort of door to a pathway we wish we had never gone down.
So fixing the hernia involved getting the cardiac clearance, getting the cardiac issue fixed, involved the pacemaker, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly, right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And we didn't know at the time there were other alternatives. We could have had the hernia surgery and handled the heart problem a different way that was more temporary. And so without any discussion with the family of the long-term implications of giving a guy a pacemaker with a 10-year battery when he was already in a position where he couldn't really participate in a conversation, those issues were simply never discussed, and we kind of segued into a pathway we wish we hadn't gone down.
So this was a full sleepy time surgery to put the pacemaker in, I'm guessing?
It was. It was a general anesthetic surgery, and that unfortunately had immediate cognitive consequences for my dad. He came out of the surgery very confused, but then after a while did recover. And that's another issue that I talk about in the book, which is that as you age, the downsides of surgeries and hospitalizations go up considerably, and so the whole the whole weighing of whether or not to do a medical intervention starts to change.
You, one of the chapters in the book, though, is called The Year of Grace. And so you actually did have a period where, I mean, it's, the progression is really heartbreaking through the book. And I pointed this out through some of the introductory materials we were talking about earlier. But just the way that it moved from hope for pretty much complete recovery or something close to complete recovery to, okay, we'll take what we get, to, oh, my God, this is just getting progressively worse.
Yeah, that's beautifully put. Thank you. We had a beautiful year of grace where I was able to fly in repeatedly and truly, truly help my parents. My mother and father were both very dominant people, and my mother ran her house like a Swiss watch. And during this year, it's almost like we both stood down. We both put our weapons down, in a sense, and she really allowed me to come in and help. So, for example, I managed to essentially train my father to walk alone down to a pool, the Wesleyan University pool, and do water walking exercises three times a week. And this is something had been suggested, but my mother had been so overwhelmed with the day-to-day care that she never could really manage to get this set up or get it in motion. And I could fly in with all, you know, a lot of new energy and really, really help them. So it was a remarkable experience. I mean, I remember meditating with them in their living room one morning, and my mother was starting to swat a fly on the fly screen, and I was sort of getting annoyed because I wanted to be quiet and meditate. And the fact that she and I sort of handled it with amusement and grace instead of getting into a little fight with each other was part of this amazing first year of grace. Another part of it was that my father and I started to exchange what you could call them love letters, and I think of them now as legacy letters, where I began to thank him in writing for everything that he had done for me as I was growing up.
But in person, certainly right after the stroke, it sounds like it was very difficult to communicate with this person with whom you'd once had very good communications.
Exactly. We couldn't communicate on the levels we used to, which would be argue about something in the New York Times this morning. But on the emotional level, I think we actually communicated better. And there was a great irony. I think because he'd been a college professor, his mind was highly developed in terms of reading and writing. And I think he probably retained more of those capacities than the average person would have because he'd used them so fully in his life. And so these letters, which were very difficult for him to write, I mean, he had to really slave and labor over them for hours. But in the end, they were like these compressed poems. They were very, very beautiful. And they're among my most precious possessions for sure.
You know, I haven't made it clear to our listeners. You did mention your dad lost an arm in the Second World War.
Yeah.
Which side was the stroke on?
You asked exactly the right question. You know, it was on the wrong side. He had only his right arm left. And that was the side that was affected by the stroke. So the ability to pick up a phone. I mean, he recovered quite a bit, probably because he only had that one arm. He recovered some use, but he would drag one foot. It was very, very difficult for him. And this was a guy who'd been a sailor. He built floor-to-ceiling bookcases for our living room down in the basement, you know, using jigs and other things to make up for the fact that he was doing all this work with just one arm.
Oh, right. Yeah, I hadn't even thought about that. Yeah, when you said the floor-to-ceiling bookcase, like, wow, vigorous guy. Oh, wait, one arm, too.
Yeah,
really,
exactly.
Literally as busy as a one-arm paper hanger.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, he'd been a person who managed, you know, that there's this Marine expression, improvise, adapt, and overcome. And that's the kind of guy he'd been. And the stroke was something that blindsided him. And he worked very hard for a year and a half or two to recover his speech, to recover the ability to talk, to do all this water walking. And then one day I remember him turning to me in the kitchen and just saying to me with great vehemence, I am not going to get better.
Wow. And how did that hit you?
Well, hard. And I knew he was right. I mean, I'd known it for a while, but it was just very, it was awful. And to see someone you love so much in this state is just very, very difficult.
We've focused mostly on him thus far. Your mother, though, she got into a caregiver support group, but at some point stopped going. Why?
Well, as I said, my mother was her own worst enemy. She was so good at so many things that she really thought she didn't need other human beings. And so my brothers and I are all Californians, so we love support groups and self-help groups, and that's kind of our way of life. And she was a kind of a buttoned-up, English-influenced South African who served tea at 4 every afternoon. And the idea of opening yourself up to people you don't know well was just really foreign to her culture and to her experience. And so she very much did things her way. And her way was pretty darn good, but I would have done anything to have convinced her to get more support earlier than she did.
And people were offering it sounds like.
Well, I think in the first flurry after a major health crisis like this, a lot of people come forward and say, is there anything I can do to help? But you have to say yes to them, or you have to say, yes, could you take my father out to lunch every Friday? It would be such a relief for my mother and so wonderful for him to have something to look forward to. But I think we hesitate sometimes to ask people to do these things. And one friend of my father's, an old colleague from Wesleyan, did in fact do exactly that. He just set up a regular schedule of taking my dad out to lunch. But if I had been a little more courageous out here in California, I would have called people behind my mother's back and simply said, would you please volunteer to do the same thing? Just take him out to lunch once a month. It would make such a difference to him and to her. But I was afraid of her. She was a tough cookie.
And you had a blow-up with her that had a year of silence, didn't you?
Yeah, I had a year of silence. I had done so much for them, I felt, and I thought we were on like a whole new footing. And then I went home, and I had the flu, so she now had two people to look after instead of one. And I'm very messy, and she was very neat. And I think I just drove her up the wall, and she ended up shouting at me on the doorstep that I was excessive, disgusting, and ridiculous and only thought about myself. And I felt, you know, where is this coming from? Have I gained nothing from all that I've done? You know? So I went back to California very hurt and really wanted an apology and didn't get it. And a friend of mine in California said she had faced a similar thing with her mother and that she had literally sat her mother down and said, if you keep doing this, I will not come out and help you. Do you understand? And she really had to, it was like a dominant submission thing where the, you know, the power changes hands, the hierarchy turns right upside down. And she realized she really had to do that in order to continue to help her mother without paying an enormous personal psychic price. And I wasn't quite courageous enough to confront my mother as directly as I should have. And so we had a long, long period of silence, and then we both kind of came around, and she was nicer to me after that and more appreciative, but I think the wound really never healed.
Katie Butler is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. It focuses largely on the experiences with her father when he got hit by a stroke at age 79 and then progressive health problems, ultimately leading to his death and all the decisions that had to be made leading up to that time.
This is a pre-recorded edition of The Exchange, so you're not going to hear the phone number and the email address given out because, since we're pre-recorded, we can't take any new phone calls or emails today.
That conversation you had with a friend, though, in which you compared notes about dealing with the caretaker parent, is that part of the reason you wrote this book? Is you needed to be able to share with other people and say, hey, look, you're not doing this alone.
Absolutely. There are 24 to 29 million people taking care of elderly parents or elderly spouses. And I feel like we all feel alone. And we don't have a map to the labyrinth of medical choices and caregiving choices that we are facing. So a huge point of the book is to say, you're not alone. You're not alone in having an imperfect family. You're not alone in being flawed yourself or not knowing exactly what to do. And I really wanted to provide this map for people, especially to understand what they're up against with the medical system itself, because the medical system, as it's set up right now, it promotes cure over care, even at a time when curing becomes futile. So you end up taking your aged parents to a million different medical appointments, none of which are doing much for the person. But at the same time, you're getting very little home health support, nursing support, social work support, the kind of things that families with an aging family member really, really need. So I wanted to not only say to people, you're not alone, you're doing your best, it's not going to be perfect, but, you know, hang in there and talk to each other, and let's start to have a public conversation about this enormous national caregiving crisis that we're involved in and this new stage of life that none of us thought we were ever going to have to face. But also, I think we need to make some political changes, and we need to get Medicare to fund much better hospice care, palliative care. Those doctors need to be paid a lot better, and we need to have a lot less emphasis at the end of life on high-tech, very expensive medical treatments. For example, a fifth of people die in intensive care, and that is a harrowing death, and usually those people never should have been put in the ICU in the first place. Three-quarters of Americans want to die at home, and fewer than a quarter of them do. So this is an enormous disconnect in the society that prides itself on freedom of choice. And I think we need to put our heads together as a culture and figure out, why are we ending up on these trajectories to the kind of deaths that we don't want to have, or we say we don't want to have?
And it seems like even the people who do give advanced directives and all that sort of stuff, they're going to get rushed to the hospital and then be there, and they say, no, I don't want the final treatment, if they're even able to say it. Yeah. But they'll end up dying in a hospital is the point anyway. And nobody, I can't imagine anybody saying, I want to die in a hospital.
Well, exactly. And there came a point where the family doctor said to my mother, don't, whatever you do, make sure you don't, your husband does not get hospitalized. Do not call 911. And that is a 180-degree turnaround, because all of this time in our lives, we've been taught to call 911 at a drop of a hat, and we believe in our bones that the loving thing to do is to call 911. But in fact, if a person in who is ready to die and is in their, let's say their late 80s or their 90s with multiple health problems, they don't want to be rushed to the hospital and have their heart shocked and their literally their ribs broken in a futile attempt to resuscitate them, or an attempt to resuscitate them that it succeeds for, let's say, 2 weeks of intensive care and then ends up in death anyway. I think, in fact, that we have to become prepared to die too soon rather than too late, mm-hmm. and to prepare for our deaths before we have hit these final crises.
While we are still of sound mind and body.
Exactly. And while we still have some time and energy to do things like make peace with people that we love, convey our blessings to them, ask for forgiveness, express our love. These are all things that my mother, in fact, succeeded in doing at the end of her life because she took such a radically different path.
I want to be careful here, though, Katie, because you're right. I think that people, of course, they want to help the people who have, you know, the person who's just fallen or something, or just they're not breathing, or they call 911. But if you have an understanding with that person already, they don't want medical care when it looks like it's the end of life. And again, how are you going to know necessarily?
Yes.
So, and for that matter, are there criminal charges if you don't get help for somebody who needs it?
Well, it's very interesting. The law is that you have the legal and the moral right to refuse or any medical treatment. It's not, it doesn't shade over into homicide. The Supreme Court has said you have the right to request the withdrawal of any medical treatment, including a feeding tube. You do not have to be resuscitated if you don't want to be resuscitated. This is such a gray area, and it's so, so difficult for everyone. It's a place where criminal law and civil law and religious tradition and the preferences of the families all kind of come into this mushy area together. And what really matters to me is that so few people are really getting the kind of deaths that they want, and these decisions are being kind of by default turned over to doctors who maybe don't know them or their families well at all. You will be revived if you call 911. I'm arguing that we really need to have an 811 system too, so that we have a system of ambulances with palliative care doctors and home health nurses who could come to a home in a crisis like that and reassure the family and really do the wise thing. Even if you have a DNR, you will be resuscitated if you call 911.
Right. You've talked in very general terms, certainly about the way we tend to emphasize the gadgets and the intensive care and all that stuff. You haven't used the phrase that you used in the book, which is perverse incentives.
Yeah.
So what you're saying then is that the real money, the real rewards for people in the medical business, even if they're not financial, are just about making sure that you use all the technology you've got to do whatever you can.
Yes, there's a phrase in medicine which is, because we can, we must. And there's another phrase that I use, which is, because it's paid for, we'll do it.
Hmm.
And unfortunately, for example, a doctor who gives you chemotherapy will get a 6% commission on the price of the chemo. So unfortunately, that's a perverse incentive to not have a conversation with you at the point where yet another round of chemo is actually very, very unlikely to help you. In fact, may even shorten your life. And that same doctor will be underpaid, barely paid at all, to sit down and have a really deep conversation with you and your family about what kind of death do you want, that really is where we are.
We're back with Kay Butler and Knocking on Heaven's Door in just a short minute. This is the Jefferson Exchange. Stick with us. A reminder, we're not taking any phone calls or emails this hour because the interview's pre-recorded. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. Kay Butler watched her father's decline in health after a late-in-life stroke. The experience moved her to write Knocking on Heaven's Door. She joined us in 2013, so we're not taking any new phone calls today. Here again is Jeffrey Riley with Kay Butler.
Katie, when we talk about the way that medicine tends to focus on the gadgets, the hardware, the intensive care, one of the changes that at least is proposed by the people who are pushing for further reform in healthcare is to do more prevention, to get people hired who can remind the diabetes patients to take their insulin so they don't end up in the ER 35 times a year, which is low side for some of these cases. No. Do you see healthcare getting into that realm of issues around dying well?
It's sort of a slippery slope. In my father's case, in 1 year, he got $22,000 worth of hernia surgery and pacemaker surgery, but he was limited by Medicare to $1,500 worth of speech therapy. The speech therapy was tremendously beneficial, and often people in these older stages of life can really use things like gait training to make sure they don't fall, adaptive yoga, a whole panoply of prevention of the kind of things you're talking about that can really make a huge difference in postponing disability. And I think in this stage of life, often it's important to postpone disability rather than trying to postpone death. But unfortunately, the system is biased because we have an enormous amount of money spent on lobbying in Washington in the healthcare sector. It's one of the three biggest lobbies in Washington. The result is it's structured for the convenience and the benefit of the makers of medical devices and drugs and also the highest paid specialties like the cardiac surgeons, et cetera. All of those are the very, very powerful Washington health lobbies where the speech therapy lobby doesn't have the kind of bucks. So I think we really need to become aware as citizens of this bias in the system toward overpaying for expensive and sometimes futile treatments and underpaying for the kind of less glamorous but very, very crucial support that you're talking about, like the prevention.
But here's a real distinction then that it sounds like we really haven't wrapped our minds around. To your father, having his heart continue to beat at the acceptable rate was less important, I would think, than for him to be able to talk to people.
Yeah, I mean, it's poignant and tragic, and you're exactly right. And until you actually put it that way, I hadn't even really thought of it. the pacemaker was something that was never on my father's list of goals, to have a pacemaker.
Nobody's bucket list. I want a pacemaker.
I want a pacemaker. He actually rejected a pacemaker a year beforehand when he still had all his faculties because his family doctor recommended against it. And as I said, my parents, you know, they were these sort of hard-bitten South Africans. They were not in favor of doing unnecessary things or wasting money. They were few frugal people, and that applied even to how they dealt with things like Medicare. So if you had said to my father after the stroke, are you interested in making sure that you maximize the number of years you have left to live? I don't think he would have said yes. If you had said, are you interested in being able to have a conversation with your kids? Are you interested in being able to walk to the pool alone? Are you interested in being able to talk well enough to order food in a restaurant? He would have said, yeah, and he would have worked for all those goals.
Yeah, a different set of goals to work for sure. Let's take a call here. We have Grumpy John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Katie Butler.
Thank you. Katie, I don't know if you had to run across assisted suicide or voluntary termination of life. A few years back, as you recall, there was a big flesh-eating bacteria scare, and I became interested in knowing, if such a thing happened, do I have a painless available exit? In short, if I slice my wrists, do I fade slowly out, or do I end up with a massive migraine? And I phoned my doctor to ask that, and they sent the police out. I said, I'm not interested in suicide. I just want information. They sent the police out to make sure that I wasn't contemplating suicide. And I cannot find the answer to that. And perhaps you ran across it.
I'll tell you, I think you raise a very, very important issue, but it's not my issue. My issue is that I think it's so important that we get to choose the kind of death that we want and that we do have a right to freedom from unwanted or inappropriate medical care. And I guess I'm probably somewhat afraid of even wandering into the area that you want to discuss, because I would hate to see the attention for this particular book taken away from the issue that I think is so important. I mean, clearly, I don't even like the word suicide, because it implies that suicide is some kind of crime. And as I'm sure you know, there was a time when suicides were not allowed to be buried within a graveyard. They were buried at the crossroads or outside the walls. And I think this is really, really terrible. But
the phrase that's in use in Oregon now is physician aid in dying.
Yeah, physician aid in dying. And really, in these cases, we're talking about hastening death by a month or two. We're not talking about taking a life that could be fully lived. I guess my concern is, I think of the 22-year-old who's temporarily depressed and jumps off a bridge. And that is somebody whose condition could be reversed. It could be a temporary thing, and 5 years from now they could be living a very, very different life. I'm not unsympathetic with the issues that are being raised in terms of making it. I think it's very useful to decriminalize physician aid in dying, because I think it also makes doctors less afraid of the very difficult conversations that need to happen with people about not doing life-prolonging measures that are just causing suffering. But it's an important area, but it's sort of not my area.
Understood. But I wonder if, as part of demystifying death, having more frank and honest discussions about the things that happen when this happens might...
Yeah,
it might improve things. But one of the focuses of your book, of course, is of course the subtitle, The Path to a Better Way of Death. I mean, there are cultures before ours that did talk about good deaths. Is that even a part of our culture anymore?
I think we had kind of a perfect storm in the 1960s. Up until in the 1400s, there was a best-selling book, and what was it called? The Art of Dying. And it was a description of how to die. It was the roles that should be played at the deathbed. Dying always took place at home. It wasn't considered an emergency. You didn't need experts to participate, usually, unless you were Catholic and you wanted a priest for last rites. But it was almost like a play. It was like a whole scenario. I've read it. It's just fascinating. And so people had some preparation. They didn't have to turn to the Tibetan Book of the Dead. They had their own Western Book of the Dead. And books like these were in circulation until the 1800s. And in the 1950s, a lot of people stopped going to church. They stopped practicing the old rituals, whatever the tradition. at the same time that we fell in love with science and we put science on an altar, and science was going to solve all problems. And people don't understand how much they shifted their unthinking faith from one set of systemic ideas to another. So we had a collision between a loss of old traditions, a loss of a sense of knowing how to bring the sacred into the dying process, at the very moment that science was holding out the promise that we didn't have to die at all and that we could always save people.
Hmm. This is a version of the exchange from our archives. It is pre-recorded, so we're not giving out the phone number and the email address today because we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. Thanks.
Let us take another call. Marilee in the Applegate, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Katie Butler. Her book is Knocking on Heaven's Door.
Hi. I have kind of a multifaceted family background with the process of dying. My parents died in my 20s, and I had the, I guess, the interesting experience, and I think it was a good experience for me, of having my mother's parents, and they lived in Marin County. And eventually my grandfather died in the 70s. And then I had my grandmother, and I kind of knew that the responsibility of my grandmother was going to be on, it was going to be something that was important for me to take care of. It would have been something that even at his deathbed, I kind of knew that he knew that I was the one that was elected. And I did do that. And I think based upon her background, what I did was phenomenal, and I'm glad. But it took a lot of years out of my life doing for her the caretaking. And then last year, my brother died, and the experience was very different with him. I was at the doctor's office with him in July, and he was, he had congestive heart failure, and his liver was giving out. And then he had two daughters that were from first marriage and two children from a second marriage. But the situation that I had was he says, if I do hospice, I won't do it unless you're here. And he lived in Aberdeen, Washington, and I live in here in the Ashland area. I live in Jackson County. But I was very, very aware that without the support of his daughters, who were kind of pretty moneyed, and I'm very poor, and I also have health problems, there was a point where I had to back away because I felt like this was going to be something that they were going to have to do the journey with him. He did die in December. Mm-hmm. He fell. He lived in a county that was a poor county economically. He couldn't get somebody, he almost needed 24/7 nursing before he died. And he ended up in a rest home in Olympia, Washington. And I'm still, he asked me to pack my bags and leave basically because I had to take him to the doctor. I mean, he was so septic that, I couldn't leave him in the house with his son, who was 12 years old. But I'm going through the process now of what my closure is going to be like because I'm not going to let that happen.
Or you want to make sure that you don't have the same effect on somebody else that they had on
you. That's exactly right.
All right. Yeah. Thank you, Marilee. Appreciate
it.
Yes, and she brings up a very, very important point here, which is, hospice is now underfunded. They are paid something like $150 a day per patient. I think this benefit ought to be tripled so that someone like her brother could actually have 24/7 care at home. The money saved for the hospital system, the healthcare system, would be immense because if you keep people out of the ICU, you save hundreds of thousands of dollars. So we're penny wise and pound foolish here. We kind of look at hospice with a gimlet eye and make sure they're not admitting people and who might live more than 6 months. And there's just so much suffering that could be alleviated if we had a more balanced approach to end-of-life health care.
There's a moment in your life that you relate in the book in which your mother broaches the subject of what caring for your father was doing to her.
Mm.
What happened?
It was overwhelming. I have her journal right here on my desk. And at a certain point, there was a weekend where my father couldn't stop brushing his teeth and went over and over again back to the bathroom. And she wrote in her journal, enough about quality of life. What about mine? And she also said, sometimes I wish he would die and set me free. And this is a woman who had loved this man for over 50 years and helped him and been his companion in life. It was tragic to see them get to this point. And she got to the point where she said to me, "Will you help me get your father's pacemaker turned off?"
Which is, after having your father say, "I'm not going to get better," definitely
yes,
the second punch.
Yes, and he also said, he told her, he didn't tell me, I only found out of it when I wrote my book, Knocking on Heaven's Door. He said, "I'm living too long."
And so what ended up happening? I mean, you actually can turn a pacemaker off.
It's easy. It's easy to disable it if you know how. It doesn't involve any kind of surgery. It's painless. The cardiologist absolutely refused. He was frankly horrified. He treated my mother and I as if we were some kind of moral monster. And he said no.
Well, I guess people can read the book if they want to find out what happened then. But this is, you know, it's a journey I don't think we're ever prepared for. And I don't know if it's going to take us starting to think about death in our 20s or something, but yeah. It certainly seems to sneak up on us no matter how old we are.
Maybe so. What I like to say is that saying to your friends, "Take me out into the field and shoot me," is not a plan. And if you do not have a plan, you may die according to someone else's plan, and it may not be what you want. And that there is the opportunity in facing our deaths of having it regarded as a sacred time. And I think with both of my parents, I got to have some of that process of saying, "I love you, thank you, please forgive me, I forgive you, and goodbye." We could say this to the people we love every day, but I think as death approaches, it's so important to do this work.
Absolutely. The book is called Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. Katie Butler, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jeff. It was wonderful.
Good to have you.